Hey everybody, I am Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, where we are joined as always by you and Throat Coat Tea, because none of us is as smart as all of us, and I can't talk without it.
I am a ginormous fan of Throat Coat. Can I tell you, it's my go-to when I get sick, and I'm so sorry you're not.
It's magical.
Yeah.
It's so good. Magical. Yeah. No, I finally feel much better after like 11 days of the worst cold I've had in years.
Yeah. We are, as I promised yesterday in our quick little blurb that we did, getting deeper into the question of whether this economy and the way it is set up right now is working as it should for enough people. That's the key phrase there, for enough people, I think.
Yeah, I think that is the only phrase, really. I got to, in service of this discussion, have an amazing conversation with Philip Kotler, who is a marketing expert, and he's written, you know, over 50 books on that topic. But he was a classically trained economist, and he's been studying the evolution of U.S. capitalism in basically real time for, like, about the last 60 years.
Wow. So he's a young guy, then. Is that what you're saying?
His journey is fascinating.
Also, and I know you've been waiting for this, the choices for the next Make Me Smart Club of Book are going to be at the end of the episode.
As far as I know, other than all of the suggestions of graphic novels, there is no rigging. Nobody has a favorite. Nobody has a favorite horse here.
Hold on. I resemble that remark because I know people out there think that I totally rigged the whole Man in the High Castle thing, which even though it turned out to be an awesome selection, I did not.
Sometimes rigging can come in the form of peer pressure. I'm just saying.
Man.
But now we're going to never going to live that down. Never. Now we're going to dive straight into part two of whatever this series is going to be called. Yeah, the ethical capitalism, the moral capitalism. Philip Kotler had a phrase, which I will I'll drop on you later. Whatever we're calling it, I hope it's eventually going to get a musical sting.
Yes.
Audience, what do you think, you know, we should call this?
I don't know. It's a good question. But to get going, we're going to play a clip from the Donahue Show. If you're of a certain age, you remember Phil Donahue. He's still around, right? Yeah. So back in the 70s, he had a daytime talk show. This clip is from 1979. A woman in the audience. The guest was Milton Friedman, a renowned economist. He was all about free market capitalism. And anyway, so this woman asks Milton Friedman this question. Here you go.
Why is it we have so many millionaires and everything in the United States, and we still have so many impoverished people who try to get up into the world? Why is it we have this lack of money where people who can't support themselves decently and get a decent job, where all these big men are up on top making oodles and oodles of money? They don't need it. They can only eat that much,
And what do you suppose they do it? If they don't eat it and don't use it, what do you suppose they do?
They hoard it.
They hoard it. What do you mean they hoard it? You mean they put it under their pillows?
That's right. No. They keep investing it.
Investing it in
what? That's right. Yeah.
What do they invest it in?
Well, in oil and everything, where, I mean, all these other people who are
trying. What do they invest it in? Don't get off the subject.
No.
What do they invest it in?
Well, they invest it in a lot of different things that the little people need.
Well, do they invest it in factories?
Huh. Yes.
Does some of that money end up in machines?
Yes.
Do those factories and machines provide ordinary working people with jobs or not? What do you suppose the productivity of this country would be and of the wage rate would be if the total amount of capital in this country today was what it was 100 years ago?
So that was Milton Friedman in 1979. He was basically fresh off a Nobel Prize in 1976 for economics. He was a monetarist. He believed in free markets. He believed in rational markets. And he was and is to this day incredibly influential. And so that's where he's coming from. And also, he didn't mind taking a lady on a talk show to task, right? Actually,
I was going
to
say, yeah, he was clearly feeling his oats.
Yeah, totally. All right. So anyway, so we're gonna get back to that in a minute. First, though, some thoughts about last week's show. And one of the things we discovered, again, I think, about y'all is that you guys like your metaphors. Here we go.
Hi, Kai and Molly and producer Jenny. The metaphor of an out-of-control AI to the U.S. economy makes sense to me, but I prefer to compare the economy to a highway with high occupancy toll lanes. For rich people, the highway serves their needs very well, but for average drivers, traffic has gotten worse. As income inequality worsens, people become more and more aware of which lane they are in.
I think that a better analogy for the economy is an ecosystem made up of corporate organisms whose success is determined by a form of unnatural selection. Just like Jonathan Haidt said in The Righteous Mind, superorganisms emerge and dominate their preferred niches, change their ecosystems, and push their competitors to the margins or even to extinction. They are not like superorganisms. They are superorganisms.
Facebook, Google, and other massive multinationals are like your pet dog that never stops growing. When they're small, they're cute, and you feed them everything because you want them to grow. You don't discipline them because, well, you're afraid they won't survive. But what happens if your dog grew as big as a house, and then a city, and then a country? What control do you think you can manage over a beast that's always ravenous and used to consuming everything and anything? Before you know it, it's consumed your ideals, good intentions, and your motto. What was that, Google? Don't be evil? I'm a pediatrician, so I see growth and development every day. Our heads are done growing by about age 2. Can you imagine if we never stopped growing? Corporate capitalism's problem is that it believes in the sustainability of unfettered growth forever. Why is there no understanding that natural systems grow to maturity and then stop growing to survive in an equilibrium?
The first metaphor I would use for the economy right now is a casino. It's rigged for the house. It's designed to take from most of the population or make it hard to get ahead. Our gerrymandered political system is stacking the deck for the, quote, pro-business initiatives, where really a small percentage are getting the lion's share of the gains. We must incent real social responsibility for our communities. Remember, those workers also coach your little league. They teach Sunday school classes. They help shape the community. So my other metaphor is from It's a Wonderful Life. We want to live in Bedford Falls, but it seems we're really headed for Pottersville.
Oh,
ouch.
Man.
Pottersville? Come on.
Not Pottersville.
Wow.
That was, who was that? Mike Katz, Nate Figlewski, Jay Nyer, and Gary Kutak.
Yes.
I have to say, remarkable as usual, you guys. Thank you for calling in. The ecosystem is the metaphor that resonates the most with me compared to an algorithm. And I think you'll hear that start to come in the conversation with Philip Kotler as well. But it's true that if the predators eat everything, like you know, there's lots of little sort of supporting characters in an ecosystem, like bugs and germs and, you know, algae and fungus, like all of these things that make it go.
Yes.
Seriously, that nobody ever thinks about.
Right.
And I think I just might have accidentally compared people to fungus,
which is not what
I meant.
That was part of my chuckle, yes.
Yeah. No, your chuckle brought me back to reality in there in the little rant. But you know what I mean.
I know exactly
if all those parts aren't healthy, it all falls apart.
Yep.
Okay. One more listener response. I want to play this cut from Liz Zimmerman.
I think the issue isn't that our model of capitalism must be tweaked. It's our expectations of systems we create that must be tweaked. If people were perfect, we wouldn't need governments and we wouldn't have to regulate markets. But people aren't perfect. Now, this isn't news, but we have been chasing the idea of a perfect system of governance and a perfectly balanced market, and that's delusional. Now, that's a bit gloomy and doesn't lend itself to many actionable steps except existential wallowing. So I think the next step is to address the assumption that people are rational actors. As a student of economics, that basic assumption always rankled me. In today's economy, it can be difficult to trace everything that happens to your table salt before it gets into your cabinet. Sorry for the gloomy take on market systems and humanity at large, but I think the faster we acknowledge that we don't know how capitalism is supposed to work when all the actors are imperfect, the better off we'll be in creating a system that assumes we're human rather than assuming we're perfect.
Yeah, so that's an amazing thing, right? So first of all, the phrase existential wallowing. Oh my God, do I love that. But
that's
also
beautiful. That's like your thing.
I know. Oh, snap. Out of nowhere, they come from you, and I'm just like, I just get biffed. But also, the point about how an economy is supposed to work when people aren't rational actors is basically the next step in the research that Richard Thaler just won the Nobel Prize in Economics for, which is behavioral economics, right?
Yes.
Milton Friedman and those who follow him and those who are in the Chicago Booth School of Business and the Chicago School writ large, they think markets are rational and the markets know and all this stuff. And the fact is, because the people in the markets aren't rational, then the markets can never be. And this, I believe, is the next step of what Thaler has spent 30 some odd years doing.
Yeah, totally. And in fact, you're going to also hear about that from Philip Kotler. So let's get to him.
Okay.
He teaches marketing, which is an interesting thing to note at Northwestern University. And if you obviously are wondering why we're interviewing a marketing expert about capitalism, it's because he trained as a classical economist. He's trained as a classical economist. I think that the throat coat is breaking me.
Yeah, a little bit, right?
And he studied under 3 different Nobel Prize winning economists, including Milton Friedman. He has had a front row seat to the 60 years of how people and companies have behaved in our free market economy. And I thought, as always, I like to go to the basics on this show with what seems like a really simple question. What is free market capitalism?
Free enterprise capitalism really means most businesses in the hands of individuals and companies who are largely free to do and run these companies the way they want. Government does play a role, a minor role in relation to that, but capitalism is a system. And as such, it consists of leaving the responsibility to private individuals and companies to produce and distribute the goods and services.
Are there other kinds of capitalism out there?
Yes. I'd say every country that calls itself using a capitalist system, and there are many, has quite different types. I want to contrast two types because they'll position the American free enterprise model better. One is Nordic capitalism, which is really those four or five states in Scandinavia, and they call theirs welfare state capitalism. Mm-hmm. It is a capitalism that is committed to widespread private ownership and free markets and free trade. So there's no difference from us. Most of the production and delivery system is in private hands. However, they also believe in supporting social mobility, and they would like to drive towards zero poverty. Hmm. Now, all that's done at a price, a higher income tax,
right.
Maybe 50-60%, depending. It varies with the income of the person.
And there is, of course, a lot of debate about whether one or the other works.
Oh, yes,
better,
yes.
Right?
I'm going to say, in fact, or predict that we're going to probably move toward the Nordic capitalism eventually. Hmm. But we certainly don't want to move to a different system of capitalism, which is called the Russian state oligarchic capitalism, mm-hmm. where the state guides the economy and owns many of the resources, and they decide on industrial policy, and they have state-owned enterprises and state-owned banks, and there's some private individuals who have become, well, Russia now has 96 billionaires. So they're really moving toward state ownership, of course, but also oligopolies, privately held oligopolies.
Would you say at this moment that we are closer to one or the other? Here in the U.S.?
Oh, we're much closer to the Nordic system. I in no way imply that we're moving toward that kind of system at all.
Okay, good. But at this moment in time, you at least have argued that our version of free market capitalism may not be working for enough people. Is that fair to say?
Well, actually, in my book on confronting capitalism, I identified 14 weaknesses or shortcomings, all of which are fixable. And I said that essentially we want to preserve capitalism in the American style, but fix the problems. The working class today in America is barely earning what they earned in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. That's not because of productivity, because productivity had been rising, but the gains of productivity flowed mainly to the rich who have the capital. And this idea that they were supposed to trickle down as gains did not happen to the working class. As a matter of fact, it looks like wealth tends to trickle up in our capitalism rather than down.
Right.
So the result is many working class people don't earn enough to live on. And the middle class is a little more positioned for that, but even the middle class has shrunk during this period.
Is this a change? I mean, we've talked to other experts who have described our economy as an algorithm that's gone a little rogue. Was there something, do you think, that pushed capitalism too far toward profit and low wages and what you've even called short-run profit planning?
Excellent question. The fact is we used to have a union movement that had some strength and put pressure on companies to share the gains in productivity in the form of better wages and benefits, including the health benefit that comes from the companies you normally work with. That movement got weaker, And consumers don't have a voice. So I think we are having a real problem of income distribution that is getting so concentrated that it may lead to our capitalism getting worse rather than better. Mm-hmm. There's so much capital around that isn't being put to good use. Apple and other companies have so much money overseas that they're not even bringing back here for their reasons, of course. And there's overcapacity in our factories. They won't run unless there's demand. There isn't demand because people don't have a livable income. Mm-hmm. What puzzles me is that capital doesn't recognize that they're committing suicide. Mm. That is to say, their factories can't operate without demand, and they're not sharing enough to produce enough demand.
Wow, there was a lot in there, yo.
There was a lot in there. Some of the 14 problems that he identified.
Not 15, not 13, but 14.
Really are about inequality. Like a lot of them are somewhat the same. You know, there's not a solution for persisting poverty. There's a growing level of inequality. Capitalism fails to pay a living wage to billions of workers, focuses narrowly on GDP growth. Like it's sort of some of the obvious things that we've identified, that we've talked about on this show. But I just think it's so amazing that he had this journey himself and sort of after all of these years came to the conclusion that, we really need to confront. That's the name of his book, Confronting Capitalism, which I promptly downloaded. It'll be my own little book club.
Wow. You're a go-getter.
And, it was only like three. It's the Kindle version is only $3. Don't tell him I told you that.
It's not about the cash. It's about the reading a book called Confronting Capitalism.
But we did start talking about it as an ecosystem and how, and almost this idea that if the predators consume everything, then they have nothing left to eat. The suicide part was what I thought was so interesting. Do you buy that?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose. I keep going back to Adam Smith. If we're not going to consume all of this, why are we making it? But here's the more fundamental part of this discussion. If we are going to reduce inequality in this society, we are going to have to separate the rich from their money. And that is going to be an incredibly difficult thing to do because the rich also have the political power.
Yep.
I had Robert Reich on this on Marketplace about his last book about 18 months ago. Fixing capitalism, I think, was his phrase. Same basic gist. And I think it's going to be incredibly difficult, which is not to say it hasn't happened in the past. Right. I mean, we had the Golden Age and then we had some reforms after that. But it's going to be especially difficult, even more so now, actually, because the concentration of wealth in this economy is so much more narrowly held and they have so much more power. But,
right. And I think that the political equation has changed significantly in terms of people's ability to influence those elections. Yeah, I don't know either. Although he also did point out that there are plenty of extremely wealthy who are philanthropically minded.
Yeah.
There is, as we've talked about, an increase in different types of companies and capitalism and people saying, I mean, I would say his response to that in our conversation was, this is a way to continue to make money.
Right.
So, but in the lifetimes of the billionaires we're talking about, I guess the real question is how long is the suicide going to take to commit? Right.
Oh, good.
How long is it going to be before the predators actually run out of prey or anything to eat or anybody to buy their goods?
Right.
Because he's sort of trying to make it a more purely capitalistic argument as opposed to a moral argument, which I actually thought was maybe more promising as a discussion point. Let's play a little more from him.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, his journey is so interesting. Having studied under Milton Friedman, he called him the apostle of free market capitalism. And yet he left classical economics and ended up in marketing. And here's what he says about that.
Well, after my master's degree in economics, I went to MIT and I studied under Paul Samuelson, another Nobel Prize winner, and Robert Solow, still another one. And they were Keynesian economists, and they believed in a more active role for government. But how marketing came about is this. I never thought in studying economics that it really was describing the real world because of the two assumptions. One is that all buyers and sellers are rational. And the second, that the sellers want to know how to maximize their profits. those can't hold up. And as you know, there's a new push called behavioral economics, which is challenging classical economics. Mm-hmm. And behavioral economics, by the way, is really a fancy word for marketing.
Right.
Don't tell Thaler.
Pure economics of how decisions occur in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Companies will ask me, how can we get more growth? And so that led me to look carefully at the capitalist system. And is it growing fast enough? If not, why not? Is everyone benefiting? If not, why not?
Yeah.
And that led me into democracy in a very interesting way, because the great concentration of wealth is being used to help politicians get elected. So we've got a corruption going on from the overwhelming concentration of wealth in the economy to a corruption of one person, one vote.
Which I believe is what I was just saying. Thank you very much. If I had a microphone that the engineers wouldn't get mad if I dropped, I would drop it. That's all I'm saying.
Well, yeah, but I don't think that he or you are saying that to suggest there's no solution, right?
No, not at all. Not at all.
So, I mean, what do you think? Like, if you're the head of a really successful multinational company, can you be convinced that over time your ability to continue making money will be significantly degraded if people don't have enough money to buy your product?
Well, all you have to do is point him back at Henry Ford, right, and say, listen, this is why he gave them $5 a day so that they could buy the Model T. The problem now is that, let's take Apple, right? Apple has $230 billion plus or minus parked overseas. There's a big drive on now to get that back, and the theory that it's going to trickle down through the rest of the economy and it's going to go back to workers. Whether or not you believe that, the fact of the matter is that Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, does not necessarily need American consumers to pay $700 for a new iPhone, or $1,000, right? If he can get people in China and India and Africa to pay $300, that's 4 billion more people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think things have changed since the day of Henry Ford. And I think you would have a tough time convincing Tim Cook or anybody that they need the American marketplace in a way that 100 years ago American manufacturers and producers did.
So then the question becomes, this is a good question for our next, you know, next guests on this program, which is, does capitalism have to fail or have these structural problems at a global level for it to actually become a problem for capital itself?
Right. So think about how much upside buying potential there is now if you are a maker and seller of things in China, right? Yes, the middle class there is 400 million people, which is bigger than the population in the United States. But that leaves plus or minus 900 billion people, many of whom are peasants and have literally dirt floors on their huts out in the countryside, but many more of whom are rising into that middle class. And the upside there for American companies and, oh by the way, European companies and sub-Saharan African countries and Indian countries, right? Everybody is to get in there and get a slice of that market.
Mm-hmm.
So the upside there is potential. It's tricky to get into the American market and find people who don't already have, say, a cell phone or, you know, a television or a laptop, you know?
Right, right. So how does that equation change, if at all, because of China's brand of state capitalism? Like, Apple arguably almost ceded the Chinese market with its latest releases because it doesn't, I mean, it's still selling chips. This doesn't get talked about a lot, but you can still buy a cheaper iPhone from Apple than the 8 or the forthcoming X. But Apple has also kept prices, you know, at a level that is out of reach to the Chinese middle class, particularly because they don't buy phones like we do. Just as one example that I'm getting too far into the weeds with.
Right.
But if China gives preference to some of its own companies.
Yes. Yeah, so China's a tricky example, right? Because
it is
a state-controlled economy.
I got too literal.
Right. The people who live in, you know, the Chinese are communists by an accident of history, which is a whole different show, which we're out of breath for, you know.
Right. But what you're saying is capitalism may be in a little bit of trouble in the U.S.
Right.
That may be still debatable,
right.
but globally, okay.
Right.
So
anyway.
Good.
Yes.
Future conversations.
That.
I, of course, asked Philip Kotler the Make Me Smart question, my favorite part of the show, and it probably won't surprise you. Here's what he said when I asked him, what is something you thought you knew that it later turned out you were wrong about?
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
Well, once I thought I understood the economy and felt it should have as much freedom as possible for people to do anything with their business that they wanted to do and have very little regulations and a very low tax rate, that was my being influenced by Milton Friedman. So I discovered, thanks to Paul Samuelson and other great economists, that we have to have a balanced system that is really both productive and also sharing in the benefits to all the people.
You know what's great about economists? They always quote who they studied under, and they name drop Nobelists like it is going out of style.
Like,
well, it's another Nobelist,
business.
And then there's another one, and then this guy, and he was on my.
Do they all just get one? Are there really only just like eight of them, and they all get a Nobel?
Right, and they all get just worked saying. Around, right? Anyway,
one thing that I want to leave you with that Philip Kotler said during our conversation, as a possible other name for this sort of concept that we're discussing, because we've been calling it moral capitalism, ethical capitalism. Those are loaded terms. I get it. One phrase that he used was enlightened capitalism, which I thought was super interesting. Anyway, so we want to know your thoughts on everything we've talked about so far, who we should talk to in the future. I think we are planning to get a more classical, conservative economist on the show for part three.
One who was originally trained in the French horn, by the way, but that's a whole different thing. I'm not sure I like enlightened capitalism, but we can talk about that.
No.
No, because
it
imparts a sentientness to capitalism, right? As opposed to us and how we look at it. But anyway.
Also, it's super, it's really elitist sounding.
That too.
I don't know. I think I like ethical so far. Anyway, let us know what you think. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Tweet us at Kai Rizdahl, at Molly Wood. Record yourselves. We love your voice memos. Keep them coming.
We did not do a Facebook Live this week, as you know, because it turns out I was in Chicago for a thing that I had to do. But we're going to do one next week, 12 o'clock Pacific on Monday. Come and see what we look like.
Totally. I'll blow dry.
No, come on.
All right, next up, and this is important. We need your vote on our book club choices.
Okay. We usually take a little break between book club books, but we want to get one more in before the end of the year, and time is a-ticking. We are running out of daylight, and so we're going to do one more.
We're running out of daylight, guys. Meta. You had a lot of great suggestions, which will absolutely carry us through 2018, probably, because now our list is almost as long as the like numbers of emails that we've gotten. Thousands of them. But we did have a particular mission for the last book club of the year, which was, I'm sorry to say, that the book had to be shorter than 400 pages. It also had to be not entirely depressing so as not to send us into existential wallowing, and maybe even a graphic novel. I can hear my son's elementary school teacher freaking out right now. So here we go.
How to start a book club.
Books are fun.
I have my own book club.
Oh, I just can't wait to read a book.
Six selections this time around. Here they go. We're just going to bang them out in order. Go.
So in the spirit of Molly's suggestion that the next book be a graphic novel, Benjamin McGinnis nominated March, Book One. It's the first volume of Congressman John Lewis's memoir of the civil rights struggle. And Benjamin said he thinks it's particularly relevant today with the Black Lives Matter movement and the NFL anthem protests. I should say there are three volumes of this graphic novel. So let's just get Book One, which clocks in at a nice 128 pages. But they do sell it in this really nice three-book collection if you are so inclined.
That, by the way, was producer Jenny, just so you know.
Yes, that's right. And I should note that this is a great one if you want to read book club with your kids, because I already own the three-volume set because my child marched me down to the local bookstore and made me drop $50 on it, which was totally worth it. It was worth it.
All right, number two.
Kendall Harris suggested Saved by Ben Hewitt. It's a true story about what happened when the author met a man living off $10,000 a year who also seems perfectly happy. This sends the author on a quest to, quote, understand the true role of money and mindless consumerism in our lives. Good book for the holidays.
Okay.
Wah, wah. And that's how everybody got a hand-knitted washcloth.
Happy Christmas, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right?
There we go. All right. Number three, Jenny's doing double duty this week.
Both Chris Day and Suzanne Cunniff suggested Prisoners of Geography by Tim Marshall, a book that uses 10 maps of what they call crucial regions to explain the geopolitical strategies of the world powers.
Okay.
I love this. I think that sounds so interesting. I mean, they all do. Okay, book choice number four.
Next up, Patrick Chaplin nominated A Paradise Built in Hell by one of my favorite authors, Rebecca Solnit. It's about how people react in the face of disasters, natural or otherwise, and why amid all the pain and sorrow, there's also a sense of joy and renewed purpose. Rebecca Solnit is the author of a book you may have heard about called Men Explain Things to Me.
Wow.
I want to read that book no matter what. That I'm just putting in a in a plug for everything, but that one sounds really uplifting. uplifting.
All right,
for the holidays.
Here's number five. Ready, go.
Phoebe Unterman, who works with us, had a great suggestion. A novel called Exit West by Mohsin Hamid, which, according to the New York Times, is a novel about migrants Saeed and Nadia, who leave an unnamed country in the midst of a civil war and journey to Greece, England, and eventually the U.S. in an effort to invent new lives for themselves.
Okay.
I know. Sounds so good. Oh, I love book group. Okay. And choice number six.
And finally, someone named Molly Wood really wants to read A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle.
I lied.
It's a classic young adult novel, which is going to be a major motion picture in March of 2018, directed by Ava DuVernay, who is the person I most want us to interview on this program. Oh, and if you listen to yesterday's announcement, sorry, Kai, we're not doing Ready Player One because that movie shifted to a summer release because Star Wars made it run away from its December release date. So maybe next year.
All right. So that's interesting about Ready Player One. But about Wrinkle in Time, that sound you hear, ladies and gentlemen, is the deck being stacked. I'm just saying.
But it all comes down to your votes.
Vote early, vote often.
You can cast those votes for any book you want at makemesmart.org. Any of the books on this list, I should clarify. We will announce the final book club selection of 2017 on our November 7th Explainathon. That's right. You're getting another one.
Wow.
And then you'll have about a month to read it, which is why we picked such short ones.
More from y'all straight ahead. But first, we got to pay the bills. I'm not sure how I feel about that music, but, you know, I don't get to choose.
Are you kidding? I love it. It's so Star Wars reminiscent. It made me do a little dance.
All right. Two more messages from y'all. Here's one from Stan Sack about our economic system.
Of course the economy is working as designed. It's the design or the algorithm or model or whatever you want to call it that's flawed. To me, when you combine our publicly owned corporate structure with current tax codes, it's only natural that the outcome we would get is the one that we have. I have worked for both family-owned businesses and publicly traded businesses, and I will assure you 10 times over that the patience and social responsibility of a family-owned business is far, far greater than a public company. I believe that this is because there is not the pressure to satisfy shareholders, most of whom are large investors or institutions that only care about the stock price going up this quarter. As for the modern tech companies, Facebook, Google, and the like, their attempt to addict the consumer is no different than Ford, Procter & Gamble, or McDonald's. For decades, business students have been taught to build brand loyalty and keep customers and consumers coming back again and again. All the tech companies have done is to put that notion on steroids and delivered. At any rate, the hard part in all of this discussion is how to do change for the better. The people pulling the levers of power of change are also the ones benefiting from the current model. What's their incentive to change to help someone else?
See, Stan agrees with me and Philip Kotler and
Kotler. He agrees with me.
No, he agrees with me. Me. It's what I said, right? It's the people who have the power are pulling the levers of power, and you have to convince them to give it up to change anything. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but Kotler also says that when you confront capitalism, you need to understand that capitalism should keep in mind the security and happiness of the people within the system.
Capitalism doesn't care whether you live or die. The idea that we have to get capitalism to compare, I can't even say it. That's how ridiculous it is. The idea that we have to get capitalism to care about people's well-being is a misnomer, right? We have to get people who are driving capitalism to care.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I agree. All right. Yes, we agree.
God.
So mad about it, how much we agree.
Colin Webster, some thoughts here about quitting Facebook and other social media, which because... Okay, here you go.
I've tried logging off of Facebook, and I find that the news feed, whether it's coming from Washington Post, New York Times, or even NPR, very closely mirrors the same sort of viral content I was getting online. In fact, in many cases, it reports about what is happening online. So even if you try and find a new news source, and even if Mr. Zuckerberg doesn't know about what you particularly like, I find out that my source of information is still essentially being driven by Mr. Zuckerberg's algorithms.
Oh, geez. Guilty.
Yeah, guilty. But, you know, I'd give him like a 50% correct on that, right? Because some part of it is zeitgeisty and what's in the news, and that's a lot of what shows up on my social media feed anyway. But we try to get stuff that is not out there on social media, right? I mean, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's all about the filter, you know, on some level. All right. In other feedback last week, I mentioned this quote that my producer on the tech show, Stephanie, likes to say, which is never trust something when you can't see where it keeps its brain. Several of you, there are Potterheads galore out there, wrote to us to let us know that that quote comes from Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, the second book. It's something Mr. Weasley says to his daughter, Ginny. Make Me Smart listener Megan Cleansing wrote to us to say this. You can bring in something from a young adult series and think about what it says in relation to Facebook and the growing AI presence in everyday life. I think it would be a great way to introduce talking to kids and young adults about how they should think about what they share on all the social media platforms and think about the greater, possibly unknown consequences of their actions.
Totally true. Amen. Because that's tough.
And apropos of this next thing, I had a whole argument with a friend of mine yesterday about why I'm not watching Stranger Things because I'm too scared.
It's scary.
I mean, I asked on Twitter, I said, listen, on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is like normal human and 10 is giant baby chicken human, which is me, where does Stranger Things fall?
Yeah.
Should I watch it? And there were like just enough people who were like, ooh, girl, it's a 7 that I haven't done it.
Not gonna.
So that'll probably go in the chicken off. We have gotten great answers from you guys on the chicken off, which, as it turns out, you guys, we have a show on Halloween.
Oh, my God.
And so the chicken off is going to be part of our Halloween episode. Please send us a voice memo. An email is also acceptable, or a tweet with the thing that under no circumstance will you ever watch, do, or try because you are too chicken.
And also, there's no shame in it. So there's so much I won't do because I'm so chicken. All right. And while you are sending us those things, or if you're on our website, marketplace.org/makemesmart, vote on our book club selection, please. We could also do it at makemesmart.org as well.
That is correct. And that is it for today.
Gotta go. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson. The senior producer is Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
And they both work here.
The executive
producer of Marketplace is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Special thanks this week to Throat Coat and the mute button. See you next week.
What about lozenges? Where do you stand on lozenges?
It's all about Cipacol.
Cipacol.
You have to give your birth date to buy it. It's so hardcore. It's like the Sudafed of.
How do you stop the Cipacol lozenge from like clicking on your teeth when you're on the air? Because that's the problem I always have.
Oh, you can't lozenge on the air.
Well, then
you
take it out and you put it on the counter when you're talking, or on the thing in the studio, the little desk, and people get crabby because there's a little sticky spot.
Ew.
I'm just telling you.
Pro tip, everyone. Don't do that.
Don't share a studio with me.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.